What happened? Oh, I went to see Ajay Mahabua again, of course, to tell him what was going on. Went to see Sundat Nanatan Mohan and leave him some of the brochures. Ajahn Chah took charge of all of the brochures, you know. If he was going to approve this, then he would, I was convinced he would actually start to influence the people who might really help. But of course, because of the contention, the difficulty and the complaints about what had been going on, he couldn't agree to say it was okay and to give it any backing. So he had to come again. So that's what he did. And of course, when he came, he arrived saying to Ajahn Sumedho, "I've come to take you home." I think, I'm not sure. So he knew, I mean, Ajahn Chah was in complete charge, you know. Either it was, he was going to approve it or the whole thing was over. And so I drove him down to see Chithurst House and drove him through the woods, brought him to the house. He went, saw everything, didn't say anything. And then at the end of it, he apparently said, he just said in Thai, I don't know what the phrase is, but it means it's good enough. And that was fantastic, of course. A marvelous load off. So once he'd said that, once he'd come to that conclusion, then he asked Ajahn Sumedho if Sumedho wanted to stay and that he agreed that he'd going to have a bash at it. And Sumedho said yes. So then it was over. And he stayed and started telling people that this was worth supporting. And again, lots more money came in and he decided to go to the States and have a holiday and go down Wall Street and the street and in a limo and smoke cool. And that was more or less it. And then of course, you know, what you do is you get out the photo albums and you see what then ensued, which was truly astonishing to me, because people were coming from all over the place. They were coming from Europe. They were coming from America. People were putting tents up, wanting to help. It was marvelous. And the most dramatic thing was that this, some Thai gentleman, I think he lived in Hampstead, I can't remember his name, he came and inquired how many tiles that was wanted for the roof, was given a sample and told 45,000, and lorries arrived subsequently with all the tiles on these lorries, which of course we couldn't use because there's a lot of work to be done before we could get the tiles on. But it was that kind of response. And then, because we needed operating cash, I called Jeffrey Beardsley, who was responsible for a trust, essentially to provide for Ajahn Panuwado, who in Bontard, and I knew that they owned some property, and it wasn't doing anything, it was grazing land. So I said, how about you selling that grazing land and buying the pastures around Chithurst House? And so I said, he said, how much do you want for them? And I said, £25,000. So yeah. So anyway, he rang me back and said he could get 25,000 quid for the property in Devon, for the land in Devon, and he would agree, and he'd got the agreement of Panuwado to do it. So we got 25,000 quid in cash to keep going with, and without having to borrow any money, because you have to remember, up to this point, we hadn't borrowed money. And that seemed to me to be rather important. And also, what was part of the policy, Ajahn Sumedho's policy at that time, which I thought was brilliant, was that when money came in or people offered things, then that's what we do with it. And our policy was to be broke. And that's essentially how we functioned, you know, not saving, not hedging our bets, not just really, you know, going out on a limb. And that was his policy. I suppose from a charity, you know, the trustee of a charity's point of view, might seem a bit irresponsible. But nonetheless, but you see, we'd already had this run-in with the charity commissioners because Terry Shide's complaint, he'd also gone to charity commissioners to complain. And of course, the charity commissioners are legally bound. Even one complaint from the public, they have to take action. And of course, I was taken by the collar and hauled before the commissioner. And I went with Ajahn Sumedho to see one of the commissioners, and he said it's a very serious complaint that what you've done is you've used the most of the amount of money, the assets of this trust, in buying property that you didn't have surveyed. You didn't have it independently surveyed or valued. And is that so? Is it not? And I said yes, it's so. Yeah, of course it is. And when he said, well, that's, you know, as a trustee, that's, how can you justify that? You know, that's serious. And I said, well, the point is, the deal was the place is derelict. Why do I need a second opinion? And and because, you know, another opinion costs money. We haven't got any money. And I said, the point is this, that I wouldn't have done it if I didn't think that Venerable Sumedho wanted to do this. I wouldn't have done it against his wishes. And I said, you are Sir Venerable Sumedho. This venture is for him and the Order of Monks. You ask him whether he thinks we should have done it or not. So he did. That's why they said, yes, I agree. I agreed with him at the time. And then, it was great actually, because you know when the things are that clear, and I said to the commissioner, look, this is a charity, this is dedicated to religious purposes. And its objects are religious. This involves faith. And if such a charity can't make an act of faith, mm-hmm. who can? You know? And he gave up. He actually smiled and gave up. And, it's the kind of stuff you can put in a report, you know. And he knew that he could put that in a report and they'd say, yeah, I can see how what you can't nail them, can you? I'll tell you just a little anecdote about the Buddha Rupa in the shrine room, which weighs, I can tell you, 800 kilograms. And I can't remember the date of this. You were already in the place, you know. People have got masks on and killing dry rot blooms in the basement, and it was that sort of period. And I got a phone call from the Privileged Division of Customs and Excise. Are you Mr. Sharp, George Sharp, Chairman of the English Sangha Trust? I said, yes, I am. Well, he said, Mr. Sharp, we've got a large piece of, it's a Buddha, actually. And it looks like it's solid gold. And it's got your name on it. So, I said, well, no papers. He said, no papers. And I said, how do you get here? He said, on Thai Airways. He said, probably first class. And I said, well, what have you done with it? He said, well, we put it in the strong room of Air Canada. And so he said, well, he said, you have to explain this, Mr. Sharp. It's a religious thing. What's it? And it's emerged from Thailand. And it has no papers. And two, you don't have an import license. I have no indication whatsoever where it's going, whether it's going to be sold or not sold and so on. And I can't release it until this all is tentative. See? So I don't know what to do. So I rang the Thai embassy and told them the story of this Buddha. And in about an hour or so later, this lady rang me. And I don't know what her name was. I believe that she was part of a family whose fortune was based in toothpaste or something like that. And they decided to send this for the monastery, Chithurst. She arrived, very worried, and with all these forms, and sat down and filled them out, and I signed it, and I gave him assurance on the phone that, you know, it was actually not for the resale, and so he was very happy with that. Anyway, getting it here was heroic. I mean, I was terribly impressed by all that. Then, much of that you know, of course, the way that the trust functioned, that is to say, three bhikkhus, three lay directors, worked very well. We never had any problems with that. And everybody knew where the decisions were made, and that this was Sangha decisions. It wasn't, you know, just a group of lay people or me or something like that. These were actually Sangha decisions. And so any antipathies towards the idea of the English Sangha Trust, which actually in the country broadly, because of past experience, there was a lot of antipathy towards the trust, and it didn't have a very good reputation. So the approval, the fact that Ajahn Mado was the president and two other bhikkhus, which were Anando and Viradhammo, were very senior, and that Ajahn Chah approved it, the ST began to take on some credibility and approval broadly. And then, of course, the fact that the number of people who may reside here is limited to 30 at any one time, and that we were also limited to only, I think, five gatherings of any size every year, festival days, I think they're called. That put a limit on something which Ajahn Sumedho had envisioned, which I didn't really know about until that time, which made this already too small. So then he began to start talking before this was, you know, this place was finished or even, you know, fully functional, in my view. He was then talking about having another center, and this was principally going to be for the benefit of the laity. And the sort of views he outlined to me about what he wanted to do more or less coincide with what he's achieved at Amravati. And I have to say, I didn't agree with that. I thought it was, I couldn't understand why he would want to do it, and said to him, why would you want to make your life a misery, you know? And why would you like to, you know, have all this trouble? And, when in fact, you know, the money's coming in, you can make Chithurst into something truly wonderful, you know, and idyllic place to be. But no, he said he made up his mind that this is what he wanted to dedicate himself to, as a sort of well, I said I thought it was doing, you know, like an Achan Chah, really, this openness, this generosity, this tremendous compassion, which cut through all the fact, you know, whether it was going to make him miserable or be a burden or whatever, he didn't care, you know. And effectively, that's what he decided to do. And once I was satisfied once I knew that he was prepared to do that, and I did believe him, and I thought he would do that. So then when Peter and Barbara, name Peter, Jackson, they rang me, Peter rang me, and Peter, of course, is a surveyor, big time company, and they'd found this residential school, and I should go look at it, and of course, wonderfully positioned, you know, got rail, M1, and it's also an area about sending natural bridge at the same time, and it's only sort of 45 minutes to an hour away. In other words, and strategically, it's to the north, and then Chithurst to the south, and about the same distance from central London. So, you know, strategically, it was ideal. And then when I saw it, well, it could look like an army camp, but it had got all the basics, structure, and the buildings weren't bad, most of them. It was likely to be cold in the summer, in the winter, because the reason why the health service and why the Bedford County Council wanted to sell it was, amongst other things, it cost $45,000 a year to heat the place. and not surprising, really, because most of the pipes ran under the ground and they weren't lagged. So they were spending all this money on heating soil. And well, we'd only been walking around it half an hour, and I said, if this is what you want to do, this is the place, you know. And I can't really think of anything better. So it was then a question of asking Peter Jackson to put an offer together for the council that made sense, because you can imagine the planning restrictions of a residential school in an area of outstanding natural beauty. What else can you use it for? You know? What would the council allow you to use it for? And the answer to that would be very few things that would they allow. And so that meant that it would depress the value of the property considerably. And there was unlikely to be very few people. There was likely to be very few people who would actually have a use for it. And so our offer of a monastery, monastic college, we call it, because that was close to the idea of school, and was pretty close. And Peter put this wonderful proposal together, sort of graded proposal, which more or less compelled the council to agree to sell us all of it, because initially they didn't want to sell all of it, they wanted to keep big bits of it back. But anyway, it was cheap enough, 200,000 quid for 37 acres and 50,000 square feet of covered space. And then we had to wait for a year because the legal technicalities of actually getting rid of it from their part, because it had to go to actually Whitehall in order to get the approval for it to be released by the health service, and that took about a year. In the meantime, the council had changed to become led by a different colour of politician, and they wanted to, actually what they did was to gazump us and say, oh, I'm sorry, it's not enough money. And so it looked very bad for a while. And so in the end, I rang the chief executive of Bedfordshire Council, and I just said to him, look, have you got authority to do a deal with me on the phone? And he said, frankly, no. And I said, who has? And he said, the chairman of the planning committee. So he gave me his personal number, and I called him, and I said, look, it's a year now, and now you're asking for more money. And you know, you are dealing with a charity here. Can I do a deal with you on the phone, here and now? Have you got the authority? So he said, I have, actually. I can do it under chairman's privilege. So I said, okay, fine. So so I said, well, how much do you want? He said, make me an offer. So I said, okay, 220,000 quid, and not a penny more. And he said, that's okay, I can get that through. And so it was done. It was a political thing. He just wanted to look good, and it, you know, and it cost 20,000 quid. And so that was fine. And then you know what happened, because, in fact, I think what Ajahn Sumedho had set in train is something that the Thai people wanted, which was something that they could see, because of the original intention was that there would be that temple, that large temple. We put out drawings of our ideas, which Thai people saw, and they looked at, you know, they liked it very much. And so, and Ajahn Sumedho was there, so it began to get terrific support. And the Thai people really wanted it to take off, and he was right. And, the local council, the people that eventually we had to fight to get the temple, when they actually saw one of these brochures, the original brochures, you know, where after we bought it, and one of the chief planning officers rang me up and said, what do you mean by publishing this drawing, you know, of all this planning, you know, all this things you're going to do on the site? So I said, well, I haven't, you know, we haven't applied for planning consent. He said, I know, that's why I'm calling you. So I said, well, look, you know, this is just a vision. You know, it said, you know, it's, that's all it is. It's an idea. So is it against the law? Well, no. And I said, well, that's all it is. I promise you, it's, I tell you, you know, eventually we'll come to you for a temple. Of course we will, because I've already put that in writing. And so you know that. But how it will look, we're not sure about. So we just have to wait. But they were scared right away, you know. And so I wasn't, it was surprising that we had to go to the Secretary of State to get it through. But the idea was to give some form to what Ajahn Sumedho clearly had a very grand vision. It's a really big one. And you see what, I mean, it's already taking that form. It can't not eventually take the sort of general form that he envisioned in the first place. And that all that money going in that direction, of course, it's tended to slow down the development of Chithurst, because, you know, the Dharma Hall project and the nice cloisters, the idea of the cloisters around the garden is wonderful, but it'll come. It'll come. Well, it's more or less up to date, and I've left an awful lot out. Thank you very much for listening.